Anybody want to give us some advice?
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
I think the danger of it being a humanitarian issue for the UN, or the danger of making it a moral issue, or which is what the Taliban is doing, or the Ku Klux Klan carrying the cross, becomes very dangerous, I think. And my point is, for the children in this country, is to learn the Constitution. And the Constitution, which is overlooked, you can call it civil libertarian, like you call tolerance or intolerance. But the Constitution is what says that, fundamentally, that all creed, regardless of creed, meaning all religion, is have the right to the pursuit of happiness, whether it is color, basic, the fundamental law of this country, U.S., United States, which is the only country in the world that has this democracy as a law coming from the people. And it is the test of the people whether they believe in democracy. If the children, if they believe in the Constitution, that is what has to be in the elementary school.
Thank you. I think that, Carol, you were making some sounds over there. We'd like to add to that.
Well, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. But I think the Constitution stands for something. You have to be, to my mind, you have to be careful with the Constitution, because people can use the Constitution in a very narrow way. So to me, the Constitution is part of a larger package. And when I say what do I think is right, I mean part of the larger package of these American ideals to which we must live up and I'll always fall from. So I think I like civil rights and the Constitution together, because we've had to do a lot of work over 200 years to make the Constitution a better basis. So yes, the Constitution, but also constitutional and civil rights in more broadly spoken.
Thank you. I think we'd like to keep the discussion as broad as possible and to touch on as many aspects of this phenomena of intolerance, or, if you like, subversion of the Constitution, and not become too mired in any one place. There was a gentleman here with a question, and then...
My name is Larry Parks. I'd like to ask a question also having to do with the Constitution, but focusing on what Professor Gluck is talking about. And I wonder if the panel, particularly the professors, would comment on the lack of scholarship in connection with how the Constitution has been, in effect, set aside. Specifically, in 1933, when President Roosevelt was inaugurated, in his inauguration speech, he says to the people and to the Congress that if they don't give him the powers that he feels he needs to address the Depression, he will take the powers he thinks he needs as if we were at war. And as a result of that, we have this doctrine of so-called emergency powers. And at that time, they amended an obscure law called the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917 to give him these extraordinary powers. The question, and the reason this is relevant today, is that these emergency powers are still in effect.
That's right.
Even though there was some effort to get rid of them, I think, in the 1980s. And these emergency powers allow the government, through executive order, to set aside all these civil liberties. And in effect, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has on the books right now, ready to be activated, laws which allow the president to intern whoever he wishes, to seize the transportation network, to seize fuel, to seize the media. So how come, when you want to focus on the civil liberties things, professors such as yourself and other researchers, I don't mean to put you on the spot, how come there isn't more legal research, more effort being devoted to these so-called emergency powers?
Thank you. I love it when people ask questions of a panel and say, don't want to put you on a spot as they sit there in the glare of the lights.
Well, you know, yeah. I don't know anything about this, but I would bet you, Mr. Parks, that there is a load of legal scholarship on this, and that the real problem is why aren't legal scholars speaking to the broader public so that the people in the broader public know what you know? I don't think it's a question of scholarship. I think it's a question of having scholarship walled off in the so-called ivory tower, and people not who know enough about these things not speaking on the basis of what they know to explain to us what's actually happening in the present, particularly what you said about once we get these laws on the books, it is they have to be rolled back one by one by one, and you know, and takes time, and they don't ever all get rolled back. I mean, I think it's more the scholars need to be chastised, and I agree with you for not getting what they know out there. So there's the education part of that, but the work mountains. Wow.
Okay.
I can't cite it, but I'm that's what I say. I don't know anything about it. But my guess is that the problem is the disconnect between what's there and getting into where we can find it. Unless you are a legal scholar yourself and, you know, do all that, that's my guess based on other things I know like that. But, you know, you could be right. There could be no paper on the emergency powers. I would be very surprised.
Okay. We have questions from several people in the audience, from the lady back here.
Hi, my name is Christine Minami, and I work for the Japanese American Citizens League. I'm actually the Washington person who works a lot with the Sikh Media Watch and the ADC, the AAI, et cetera, and was one of the organizers of the rally to which you referred earlier at the National Japanese American Memorial to Patriotism. And my observation, and we've been following this a lot, it's very important to us clearly as a community, as well as people interested in civil rights. And I've been struck by something, the danger that I saw personally, and I wanted to get comments back from the panelists, was in 1942, it took 2 months for one person to institute Executive Order 9066, which allowed for the exclusion of enemy aliens. It didn't specify by race. And Germans and Italian immigrants were also interned under that, in addition to the Japanese-American community. In 2001, it took 1 month for the entire Congress to pass the U.S. Patriot Act, which allows for essentially the same legal thing, the same legal acts. That is, there's very strong parallels between after Pearl Harbor, first-generation Japanese immigrants were rounded up by the FBI, taken off, and their family didn't hear from 3 months. We're hearing that also from the Arab American communities as well as other people of color. And it seems to me that this is, while I don't think internment will happen again, it seems to me that there's a strong division between us and them. Either you're with us, as President Bush says, or you're with them. And that's defined along lines of nationality and citizenship. It may be to some degree color, but it's very starkly and legally defined in that respect. And I wanted to hear back from the panelists how you thought we can get past that in terms of this perception of anybody who does not hold, you know, an American passport as being outside of the flag of patriotism. We wrap it around us tightly, but we exclude certain people. And they may have been here for 15, you know, generations, but if they look different or if they speak with an accent, it doesn't matter. Your comments,
as Albert Mochaber said earlier, I think the problem that you're referring to actually applies also to people who do hold the U.S. passport or do hold a U.S. identity document. If the panelists have some comments.
Well, let me step out because, you know, Albert can also shoot me down. But, you know, I mean, we mustn't elide the fact that during World War II, Japanese Americans also were victimized, right? Which is obvious, right? We know that. So, like, citizenship did not protect them because of those emergency detention powers under which both could be quickly disposed with. My understanding is since the 19th century, the U.S. Supreme Court has made no distinction between citizen and non-citizen on the basis of the Constitution. The Constitution does not say that all citizens will have these rights. It says all persons. And the Supreme Court has consistently ruled that ostensibly the Constitution protects non-citizen as well as citizen. Of course, that might change with the present court and so forth. But I think citizenship is important, but it also, that is, the Constitution also protects non-citizens. But citizens and non-citizens could be have their rights diminished very quickly.
Allow me to shoot.
Yeah.
The case of ADC versus Reno clearly made that distinction, unfortunately. I agree with Gary, and that I think that's what the Constitution says, and I think most Americans think that's what the Constitution says. But a very conservative court, by a 5-4 decision, ruled that that would not be the case, that the non-citizens would not enjoy the same due process rights, unfortunately. We're waiting for an opportunity to bring that back up. Unfortunately, I think this era will probably give us more than one opportunity to do so. With respect to, you know, whether or not, why it took only a month for the Congress to do it, I think because most people were paralyzed. The Arab American community had self-censored itself out of fear and a false sense of guilt for what had happened. Nobody in the Arab American community had anything to do with that tragedy, and everybody was opposed to it and had a hand in helping victims or were themselves victims, maybe twice over. But the Congress had no excuse. I think the fact that they call it the USA Patriot Act left them with the dilemma. I'm either with or against. And that's a false dichotomy. That's not the case. And that's where we have to start saying no. That's not the – you're either with the Constitution or you're not with the Constitution. You're either with the Bill of Rights or you're not with the Bill of Rights. You're either with the full body and history of the United States or you're not. That's really where it should be framed. Like one person said, we shouldn't be wrapping ourselves in a flag but in the Constitution. And we shouldn't be burning the flag. Maybe we should be washing it. Those are the types of analogies that we have to put out there. Spin doctors are out there. Problem is we don't control the airwaves. With the exception of news agencies like Pacifica, most mainstream media was, as Professor said, within 45 minutes, already forming opinions which set the whole mainstream thinking. And that includes for the Arab Americans themselves. We read the same media, we watch the same media, we read the same textbooks as everyone else. And that sets our minds. So we need people to speak out. You folks are the hope.
Was ADL Reno Supreme Court or District
Court? Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Okay. Because when we talked
earlier, I think we have time for just a couple more questions. There's one lady down here who had asked for the microphone. Very good. And then there was one here. Yes? Was. If you could wait for the microphone, please.
My family is Italian-American, and we actually came across one of these internment cards from my grandmother, and we never knew what it was, but it basically said that if she was called upon, she had to report to the authorities or she could be arrested, and we never knew anything about this. Could you maybe talk a little bit about anything that you might know about this?
Well, Italian-Americans were interned. I mean, you probably know more about this than I do, but there was not in as great numbers, obviously, as the Japanese-American. I mean, it's a different dimension, but they were interned, right?
Yeah, but they were also wrongly suspected. I mean, they were investigated by the FBI, and they were presumably both Germans and Italians who had links to fascist organizations. Now, obviously, they were incorrect in many cases, so your grandmother was no doubt exempt from that. But there are several books on the subject, and I'll be happy to tell you about them.
Very good.
Can I go ahead. I just wanted to ask something about the last question, but go ahead. Wait.
Yeah, I think you had a question up there on the aisle and had one here. Yeah.
My name is Diane Shihab, third generation Arab American on one side, and on the other side lived in Beirut for 8 years, where I got to know about the Middle East issues, and then later in studying in Paris. Everybody, the question I asked of everybody, but especially of Professor Gluck, because she touched on more painful issues that I grapple with every day, is the problem is with the salad bowl issue is that Professor Gluck said it's a little bit difficult when everybody is defining themselves as hyphenated, etc. But people usually do it when they're feeling left out of the mixing bowl, whatever it was called, the melting pot, the African Americans. They were feeling, well, they weren't entitled to a past or to an opinion or something about their own person. And as an Arab American, I often do not agree with the politics of the United States, which doesn't mean that I don't love my country. And it's a very difficult position because, as you all said, as soon as you don't agree with everybody, it's like you are a traitor. But, I mean, there are unfair things going on, and it's really hard to know what to do about it, how much you can stick your neck out without having your apartment investigated behind your back and whatever. So I would have liked to know, you know, what in particular maybe Professor Gluck has to say about this.
Well, you know, I've thought a lot about this recently and about, because I read I read a lot of European press. I read a lot of non-American press. So I see this all the time from outside, all the time. It's a very painful picture looking at the United States from outside right now. I wish that everybody could do that. You would be horrified, I think, by how we look. That led me to the comment that I just skipped across a minute ago, which was, we have an obligation to break that 95% support rate. We have an obligation to start speaking up because we have all been cowed. And we have all been cowed because I hear this kind of complaint about all sorts of things, not just from for reasons of ethnic discrimination and ethnic profiling. I don't really believe that the U.S. I say this without, I did study lots of polls and I saw that 95% support what the Bush administration is doing, but 95% think they should do it multilaterally, and 84% think they shouldn't do it military means. And before you know it, you realize that this is not a consensus that can't be broken apart, because they couldn't. It adds up to 600%. So I am now thinking more and more that it's up to all of us, hyphenated, unhyphenated, to start speaking up about lots of things. Because the only thing that this country, that our administrations listen to are the polls. And if you are unhappy right now with what's going on, all you have to do is threaten this particular president with what happened to his daddy. And, win the war and lost the election. And I've really sort of changed a little bit on what, and that's why I said common ground and democracy before. We need to all get our complaints, which are very various. Some people don't like the war in Afghanistan. Some people don't like the military trials. Some people don't like the USA Patriot Act. That's great. Everybody should say all of that. And when these pollsters could start to hear that, that's actually the way that the United States works, for better or for worse. And that's why I was talking about the common ground. So that's not the answer to your question. But somebody said, how do we get past that? We can't get past it with the preaching. I don't think so. I mean, we can get education helps, and playing with Albert's children is very important, and I agree with that, and I'll come live with them myself. But in fact, I think we have right now to break what's the immediate problem? We have to break the fact that you got Senate support almost to 100% for something that's called the USA Patriot Act because it was called the USS Patriot Act and because it's times of crisis. Enough.
Okay, I think there are many more questions, and I think we can follow up with questions after the formal panel this evening. I've been given the flag that we're at 8 o'clock, and we have to close up. Since Dr. Gluck has finished off on mentioning polls, and if you'll forgive me, another UN reference here, I think in the discussion this evening, which started off on a discussion about racial tolerance. What strikes me is that racial almost doesn't enter into the equation in the sense that the touchstone here seems to me to be the fundamental rights that everyone holds dear regardless of race, and that the tolerance of one another has to be based on those fundamental principles. It struck me when the Japan Society invited me to be part of the program this evening, immediately what came to mind was a 1999 Gallup poll, since you mentioned polls. There are different kinds of polls in the world. In 1999, the Gallup organization did a poll of something like 57,000 people in 60 countries around the world. And they basically asked people, you know, what mattered to them most in life. And ultimately, there's the UN connection. How did the UN fit into that? And what was the UN's basic function? What was the most important function the UN could perform? And one might start off by thinking that people would think immediately of peacekeeping, of action by the Security Council, maybe development work, maybe other things. The vast majority of the people who responded, and this was a poll that covered
a great many countries in all regions. I mean, obviously, 60 countries is not a majority, but the vast majority of the respondents said that the main job, the most important job of the United Nations should be protecting people's human rights. Human rights was the touchstone. And it struck me, looking at that and looking a little bit further at the report from that poll, and they found that the younger the respondent, the more likely the respondent was to cite human rights as being the UN's most important job. And I think, having listened to you all tonight, and I thank the panel very much for the advice that they've come along, and I'm sending my kids down to Albert's house to play with his. I really think that is the touchstone here, that ultimately we can talk about races, we can talk about minorities, we can talk about that sort of identity activism or identity politics, but the touchstone is really individual human rights and fundamental principles that allow us to see one another as human beings. So I'd like to thank you all very much for what I found a very stimulating discussion.
You were just listening to a panel discussion, Racial Tolerance in Times of Crisis, Japanese and Arab Experiences, held at the Japan Society in New York City last month. Next, we'll hear from two Canadian activists who work in the area of immigrant and refugee rights. They'll address new Canadian legislation that closely mirrors the USA Patriot Act.
On va commencer avec Pietangeli Lina. Pietangeli est un membre, un avocat avec le Conseil canadien des réfugiés ici à Montréal. Et aussi un militant dans la communauté sri-lankaine dans la ville de Montréal.
My name is Pietangeli. Actually, I'm not a lawyer. I wrote down advocate, not avocat. So. But I do my best. I want to start off by just telling you what my understanding and premise is for what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to look at the C-11, which is the changes to the new Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, and compare that with C-36, which is the new Anti-Terrorism Act, or bill. And I'm also going to mention a deal that's being negotiated right now, which is called the Safe Third Country Agreement between Canada and the United States. So hopefully I can try and make those three different pieces of proposed legislation make some sense to you. And to start off, the way I see these three pieces interacting is, and how I believe that we should look at them is that Since C-36 has been proposed, there has been a lot of discussion over the loss of civil liberties for Canadian citizens. And my perspective is that all of these aspects are ways that Canadian citizens may lose civil liberties or may suffer a lack of freedom or loss of freedom. Those have always been in effect under the Immigration Act for non-citizens. So the same ways that people are now very excited that not that citizens may lose civil liberties has always been in place for immigrants under the Immigration Act, and even more so for refugees under the Immigration Act. So I think it's important to not just focus on what may happen to citizens now as a result of C-36, but what C-36 has borrowed from the Immigration Act, and how immigrants have always been had a less civil liberties and protection under the Constitution and the Charter than citizens have. And that should be the way that we understand this. And also with C-36, it is primarily, hopefully this will become clear as I explain the legislation, it will be primarily people of color, immigrants, refugees, who will feel the brunt of the new anti-terrorism legislation. So, there is a bill called C-11, and it's sweeping changes to the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, and it became law just in December of last year. It will be implemented, they are hoping, by June 28th. So in between now and then, there's this huge discussion of this massive document of regulations. And they do this tricky thing where they pass in the House of Commons an act that has some of the stuff, but then half, the majority of the other ways that the bill will affect immigrants and refugees is not discussed in Parliament, is not open to the public for discussion, but is passed through these regulations that not many people have access to see. The Canadian Council for Refugees, where I work, we happen to be in a privileged position of negotiating with the government on these regulations, so I'm going to try and explain some of these things to you so that you understand how C-11 already has already framed immigrants and refugees as a threat to national security. And what C-36 does is extend those to Canadian citizens as well, and then broaden the terms a lot more. So, one of the points that has come out in the regulations on C-11 is that they seem to feel like it's okay to detain minors, which is people under 18. So detention of children has already been happening in detention centers in Montreal, Toronto, and in Vancouver as well. And this is something that we've always opposed, but this new law, this new act, is not going to, on the contrary, has not removed the desire to, or the ability of the government to place minors in detention. And basically they're saying that if there's adequate detention facilities and services, that minors can be detained. And furthermore, they've also suggested that in the regulations that minors could be, like children, could be detained if they have been suspected of being controlled by smugglers or traffickers. Because one way that people enter the country illegally is because the legal avenues for entering the country are so difficult and so strict and so racist that a lot of people come in illegally. And so people get smuggled and trafficked into Canada, and we oppose any kind of detention of minors, but especially the idea of detaining minors to protect them from people smugglers and traffickers is pretty stupid. So we suggested that at least they should find safe houses that young people should be put in. Another point, and this is a fairly large one, is the permanent residence card. And this is supposed to cost $287 million over the next 5 years to introduce this tamper-proof ID card. And it's being marketed as, it's being marketed as a travel document, not an ID card. But if it's something that all permanent residents are supposed to have, then it becomes de facto like an ID card. So one of the things that we're worried about is because the process of applying for this card is so ridiculously time-consuming and also very, very invasive. I'm going to explain that people, like young people, people who can't afford to get the card, people who have people with disabilities who have like less mobility than able people, may not get the card. Older people may not get the card, and so they may be denied services because they don't have that card. So it is supposed to be a travel document. So basically, it replaces a piece of paper that most permanent residents have right now that says that they're a permanent resident. You have to take this piece of paper with you every time you leave the country, and without that piece of paper, you can't get back into the country. So it's nice to have a plastic card, but one of the things about this card is that they want to put biometric information on it, which means, like, could be a fingerprint, could be a retina scan. None of this is on my passport, right? I don't have any of that information on my passport. So there's aspects of the way this permanent residence card is planned that implies that the government feels that immigrants are extremely suspicious, because they're asking immigrants for way more information than they are asking for the average citizen who's applying for a passport. So what happens is, if you become a permanent resident after June 28th, if you were a permanent resident before June 28th, or if you have to renew your card, the card's good for 5 years, you have to fill out this form that is crazy. It's like a million times more difficult than getting a passport. Besides having a guarantor, which everyone who wants a passport has to have a guarantor, you have to have the names and addresses and contact numbers of two Canadian citizens who will vouch for you. And you also have to supply several certified copies of this document and that document, which if anyone's ever tried to get these kind of things, you know it's difficult. And also you have to give them information on who you've worked for, where you've lived, and if you've been to school, where you've been to school for the last 5 years. None of that is ever required of Canadian citizens who are applying for a passport. So what are they trying to say? That that permanent residents are suspicious because they're not Canadian citizens, therefore the government has a right to ask them extremely intrusive information. And another point is that the case of Ahmed Ressam, who is an Algerian guy who was caught trying to smuggle explosives into the U.S., is always brought up as an example of how, you know, it's so easy to forge Canadian papers. Well, I mean, it's easy to forge any country's papers, really. And he got a passport using a baptismal certificate. He wasn't walking around with a permanent residence paper. You know, so at least if they're going to make it harder for permanent residents if they're going to make it so hard for permanent residents to get this card, the least they should do is make it hard for Canadian citizens to get a passport. So there's a real difference in the way they're treating citizens and non-citizens. And this is, you know, always been part of the way the Immigration Act is, obviously. But C-36, we see, oh God, 5 minutes. The point system is another thing that is part of C-11, and with the point system, basically the government is ripping off immigrants by upping the number of points that you're supposed to get from 70 points to 80 points, and it's really, the way they change the criteria really discriminates against working class people who have skills, but the government doesn't think they have skills. So people whose files were in the system before these changes were made will not get their money back, and they paid at least $500, if not more, just to apply. So the government is saying, you applied, we changed the rules, we know that you'll no longer be able to come to Canada as an independent immigrant, but we're keeping your money. And what they've done is given them an extra 5 bonus points, which isn't really going to help anybody actually get in, so it's basically robbery. And if you know how much, like, $500 costs, like the equivalent of that in other countries, it's a lot more. So it's like taking, you know, maybe 6 months of somebody's salary or more. Some other points are, let me see. Well, I'm going to talk about the Safe Third Country Agreement since I have such a short number of minutes left. Basically, since September 11th, there has been a lot of cries from opposition and you know, all kinds of anti-immigrant, anti-refugee people to harmonize our immigration laws with those of the United States, which means like having the same visa requirements for like the same list of countries that the United States requires a visa for those people to enter their country, that Canada would also add all of those people onto our own list. And we actually already have added 5 new countries to the list of countries that require where people require a visa, and that's predominantly countries where people of color come from. So you can't just buy a plane ticket and come here. The United States has, a safe third country basically means that anyone who comes to the U.S. and then gets to the Canadian border and says, I want to make a refugee claim, would not be allowed into Canada just because they landed in the United States. So we say, you should make a claim in the U.S. Now, everybody knows that the United States has lower standards of refugee protection than Canada. They have different international agreements that they've signed, so our systems are not equal. As bad as the Canadian, or as many flaws as the Canadian system may have, in some ways it's still a lot better than the United States. And a lot of people feel that refugees shouldn't have a choice as to where they make a claim. They call that asylum shopping, which I think is really, really unfair, because obviously there could be a lot of good reasons that someone might have for wanting to make the refugee claim in Canada as opposed to the United States. For example, you might have family here, or you might have contacts here, or your country might have been supported, an oppressive regime in your country might have been supported by the United States, and so you don't want to live there. You know, I mean, these are valid things that refugees should be able to take into consideration and decide if they want to make their claim in Canada. So it's really good for Canada because we're going to have a lot less refugee claimants coming, because I think it's 2/3 of people who make claims in Canada enter via the United States. So the United States are not particularly gung-ho on the idea, because they're going to have a lot more people, because all of those people who like took a flight to the U.S. will have to stay there and make their claim. And you know, people are detained much more readily in the United States than they are in Canada. So I'm just going to, well, I didn't really get to, well, I really want to just mention this one point. Okay, there is, I want to give you an example of how genuine refugee claimants who have not committed any kind of breach of national security or have been involved in any kind of terrorist activity get caught under the nets of these broad and vague definitions of terrorism, membership in a terrorist group. For example, Nelson Mandela, if he applied to Canada to come as a refugee, he would be refused because the African National Congress, which we know to be a movement for a national liberation, is considered a terrorist group under our immigration laws. So there is no nuances that are really understood by the government that distinguish between an international terrorist network and a genuine movement that's fighting an oppressive regime. For example, like the Liberation Tamil Tigers of Elam. And there is a guy who recently got landed just in December, who was from Turkey, and he was a Kurd. And I don't know if you're aware of the Kurdish resistance in Turkey, but because he came and he applied as a refugee, and he got accepted as a refugee, but he was in limbo without getting his permanent residence status for almost 10 years, just because he was a Kurd and he had been involved in the Kurdish community, and CSIS believed that he was doing some sort of terrorist activities. And this guy, like, they had no proof against him, and for 10 years he, you know, couldn't get a good job, couldn't sponsor any family to come here, couldn't move on with his life, couldn't get a student loan, couldn't leave the country, simply because he wasn't landed. And this is like a really good example of how if we don't have clear definitions of what it means to be a member of a terrorist organization or what it means to take part in a terrorist activity, a lot of innocent people are going to be caught under this net of suspicion. Okay, so I have 1 minute. And there are watchdogs. There are watchdog groups that try to keep tabs on CSIS and this, you know, like, for example, there's CERC, which is the Security and Intelligence Review Committee. And unfortunately, they don't have much enforcement power. So even though they can say to CSIS, look, this person that you have a security certificate against, who you won't, who preventing him from getting landed, has done nothing. Doesn't matter how many people intervene, CERC can make recommendations, but they can't force CSIS and CIC to drop their allegations. So, and I mean, Sami is just an example of these. He's one of many refugees long before Bill C-36 came into play. So you can imagine now with Bill C-36, there's going to be even more people who are suspected of doing this or that, but probably haven't done anything.
I'm going to talk mostly using examples of real people that OCAP works with every day to expand on what potentially has already talked about. The fact that this legislation that we're here discussing this evening is just an extrapolation of the way that the Immigration Act has worked for a very long time and the way that the Canadian state has operated for a very long time, with racial and economic discrimination coming down through its laws. And, you know, this is nothing new. After September 11th, there were 800 people who were arrested and detained in Canada in order to be questioned on the basis of suspected terrorist activity. We don't know how many of those people are still sitting in detention. Many of them have, we do know, been held in a jail in Toronto called the Metro West Detention Center. And those people, largely of Arabic descent, are being held, have been held in solitary confinement. And they're having their hearings taking place within their cells. When they go to meet their lawyers, when they finally do get access to legal counsel, they're strip searched on the way to and on the way from every single time. This eats into the amount of time that their lawyers are actually even able to meet with them. And we know that there have been deportations taking place straight out of those cells from inside of this jail in Toronto. Likewise, in the United States, after September 11th, there were more than 1,000 people picked up and detained on the grounds of investigation into alleged terrorist activity. And OCAP came into contact with what we know now as the only Canadian citizen, the only Canadian citizen that we've been made aware of detained in such a way in the U.S. Shakir Bloch's wife came to OCAP and also to comrades of ours in New York, letting us know that shortly after September 11th, her husband had disappeared. She hadn't heard from him in 6 weeks, had no idea where he was, and wanted, you know, action of some sort to be taken on this. She had no idea what to do. And OCAP wrote a letter to the Department of Foreign Affairs, you know, demanding that, as is their responsibility, they look into what was happening with a Canadian citizen in the United States. And as it turns out, the consulate hadn't acted on any of these sorts of queries until OCAP made the letter public. And within a day of this letter going public, the Canadian consulate went to the detention center in New York City where Shakir is being held and, you know, met with him, attempted to find out what was going on. He had been picked up about 10 days after September 11th and is actually still sitting in jail. So the Canadian consulate moved after this letter was made public, after the press picked up this story. But as things played out, the American government leaked another document saying Shakir had signed away his rights to consular intervention. Apparently the signature on this piece of paper is barely legible, but this document being made public then was supposed to, you know, waive the responsibility of the Canadian government and the Department of Foreign Affairs in this situation at all. So what has happened now is that Shakir actually has been charged, so he is now part of the criminal injustice system in the United States. He's still awaiting a full-fledged trial, and the Canadian consulate has once again backed off. The Canadian government has again backed off. They've done nothing to move this man out of what is a maximum security detention facility. Just to let people know, usually with immigration detainees, they're put into an immigration detention center. You're not put in shackles. You're not under 24-hour lights. You're not in solitary cells. You're certainly not taunted by American prison officials about your supposed connection with the bombings in New York City. And the Canadian government hasn't done anything to move him out of this facility, despite the fact that what he's being charged with is illegal entry into the U.S., and this is something that happens all the time. This is, you don't have the right paperwork, you went to find work, he was born in Pakistan, he's a doctor, he was seeking certification so he could practice medicine in North America. These kinds of border crossings happen all the time, but the Canadian government has, you know, taken its hands right off the situation. And another important factor in what we're really working to press on is they've done nothing to find out how many other Canadian citizens are jailed in this way. And that's, you know, that's clearly clearly a responsibility of our government. To explain what OCAP is, it's an anti-poverty organization that's based in Toronto. It's been going for about 11 years, and for about four of those, we've been doing specifically immigration work. It's a combination of helping people deal with the legal tangles of filing refugee claims or humanitarian and compassionate claims, but we also tag team that with direct action. And we've worked with over 50 families in those 4 years and have met with an extremely high degree of success. And what our success is based on is it doesn't take that much to force an official in the immigration system to have to deal with this person, the claimant, as a person. So immigration, OCAP takes a group of people to whatever office, the enforcement center, the local immigration office, with a group of people, be they members of you know, various labor groups, be they people from the person's own community, and basically disrupt the workings of that office by being there with a large crowd of people and demand that we meet with a high-up official in whatever office we're at, and that they sit down with the person whose case we're working on and tell them to their face, listen, it doesn't matter that you may face torture if you return to your country of origin. It doesn't matter that you might have to decide whether or not to take your child with you back to the country or potentially be separated from your child. I have the power to make that decision, and I'm going to make that decision, and I'm looking you in the face and telling you that. And you would be amazed, it's not amazing actually, that people have a really hard time dealing with that, you know, sense of personal responsibility. And that's the way that the system operates. You don't have to deal with people that are called illegals or people that are called refugee claimants as people. They're an ID number. They're, you know, a sometimes badly filed claim in the system. So OCAP turns that upside down and forces the bureaucracy to deal with people as people. One case that we worked on for quite some time was around a woman from Uganda. Her name is Sarah, and she has several Canadian-born kids and a husband who lives in Canada as a Canadian citizen. And Sarah came to us actually because we were at enforcement doing an action around someone else, and soon after her case came to our attention, a warrant was issued for her arrest, and immigration officials went to her door Saturday morning, 11 a.m., picked her up and put her in detention in the Celebrity Inn. The Celebrity Inn is a family detention center, actually right across the street from the airport, very conveniently located for nighttime removals of families, very easy to put them on planes. Sarah was held there with her youngest daughter, who was about 9 months old at the time, and Celebrity Inn actually has an interesting policy. They don't provide anything for people who are in detention who are Canadian citizens. So if that's a 9-month-old baby, doesn't matter. No diapers, no food, no medical attention. As long as you're a Canadian citizen, you're not their responsibility. So in that situation, OCAP threatened to go to the press with this, and you know, the Celebrity Inn has a history of not meeting human rights standards for prisons, and they balked, obviously, at the threat of that, and dealt with the situation. But in Sarah's case, we then later on in her, you know, in her situation, took about 150 people with us to the enforcement center and demanded a meeting, like I was talking about. And you know, the results don't come right away. Immigration isn't going to capitulate the next day or a week later. It's something that, you know, doesn't look good. But Sarah today is landed, and she is going to be able to bring kids of hers that are living in Uganda to make up, you know, her family here in Canada and continue to build on that life that she started here. In terms of the way that C-36 and C-35 and 42 are coming down in terms of immigration, there's $49 million that's been allocated to enforcement, border patrols. There's $4 million going into building new, larger, longer-term detention facilities. One of the things that is extremely concerning is that in coming into Canada, immigration never used to have the power to detain people immediately at the border. And now, if they do not believe that you are carrying valid paperwork, if they believe that your documentation is false, under this new legislation, they have the ability to detain you and your family for an indeterminate amount of time. And, you know, imagine this scenario. You're coming from, as many people do, a country like Somalia with no established government, certainly no passport offices where you can go and, you know, apply for the right paperwork. And you're forced, because of the rules, to enter into Canada to get some kind of documentation. That is found to be not true. You end up in jail. So that's one of the, you know, a very serious change that's going to affect a lot of people. In terms of the sorts of things that OCAP has seen after September 11th, like I said before, it's a heightening of the economic and racist thuggery that the government has long practiced. Somebody was referring earlier to visa requirements becoming harmonized with the United States, and there has always been a huge flow of migrant workers coming into Canada. The IMF estimates that $70 billion is sent by migrant workers home to their families in other countries. And you compare that dollar figure to the amount of foreign aid that gets distributed around the world, and I can tell you that it far surpasses it. But we've worked with refugees from, or people that are called illegals from countries such as those where people are fleeing very difficult economic conditions. And those are the kinds of people that are already starting to feel this crackdown. A woman named Brenda that we're working with from Grenada, she had a scenario where immigration showed up at her door as well. And you're supposed to get written notification that immigration wants to remove you. And that paperwork was never sent to her. And the officials showed up. Finding Brenda not at home, they instead picked up her babysitter, a woman named Shirley Ann, who's been in Canada since she was 13. Shirley Ann was summarily arrested, detained, and within 10 days sent back to Grenada. So we're seeing a speed in terms of enforcement and, you know, this the immigration procedure that we haven't seen before. And Brenda's situation is also a perfect example of the way that under immigration law, you're supposed to be entitled to have a humanitarian and compassionate claim heard. You present this claim, immigration is supposed to consider the details of your story and then make a decision. But what often happens and what's happening in her case is your deportation gets scheduled before they ever consider your HMC. So, you know, the wheels grind in such a way that your story never even comes before whatever immigration official who's going to have whatever biases he or she already has. You know, your date's scheduled long before that situation ever arises. Just to bring home the point that, you know, yes, there are serious changes that have happened after the attacks in New York, but these kinds of stories and this kind of discrimination has long been true. We worked a while back with an Afghani refugee named Aziz who came to Canada and spent 5 years going through security checks. He initially, upon arrival, had an interview with the RCMP that lasted 8 hours. And during that interview, the RCMP found no grounds to suspect him of anything, but took 5 years running him through, you know, the rigmarole of security checks. And OCAP, in his situation, took actions in Ottawa at the offices of CSIS and of high-up enforcement officials. And only years later, after Aziz did get his landing, after his son returned to Afghanistan to look for work and was never heard from again, only later did we hear from a lawyer in the community that the manager of the immigration office where Aziz's case was being heard had personally sped through Aziz's landing as a result of the disruptions at the offices, the enforcement and CSIS offices. So I guess if people want in the question period to ask me about our larger scale campaign, the things that OCAP has come to Montreal to meet with groups to talk about, we're forwarding a campaign that's based on three basic demands around disappearances and Afghani refugees. And people are going to be able to plug into this, you know, Vancouver, Ottawa, Montreal, Toronto. And if people want to ask questions about that, I'd welcome it. But I also want to remind you that as a result of this new cabinet shuffle, You've got the former Minister of Sport, Denis Kudera, who's now the new Minister of Immigration, sitting right in this city. And, you know, the only thing that's sort of been in the press about him so far is that he plays a mean game of golf. But the opportunity for action is on Montreal's doorstep. And we OCAP is looking to fight with groups here and, you know, in cities across the country to make it clear that this is supposed to be a place where free flow of humans is as acceptable as the free flow of trade. You know, the war did not start 4 months, 5 months ago. The war started a long time ago.
You were listening to two speakers at a conference in Montreal held by Convergence des Luttes Anticapitalistes last month. Thanks to CKUT in Montreal for that tape.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
For my guns and my saddle will all